Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known primarily for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the further you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always we plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much for your disclaimer and sharing with us all this good information. Ladies and gentlemen, just as a recap real quickly, over the last 5 weeks, 6 weeks actually, because we had GW here the last Monday of November, we have covered, and the purpose for this is what we've covered so far and where we're continuing to go, is to give you the background understanding, the education, in what you need to understand with regards to aspects of the law as it is written. And it is nothing that you have ever learned before, except perhaps through this portal. So far we've covered citizenship, we've covered our money system, we've covered the SESTK Trust, we've covered the IRS, and lastly, we've recovered what exactly is the United States. Tonight, we're going to talk about the courts that we have available to us here. Let me just say that I am reading from a book written many, many years ago by a gentleman who was an information provider for us before he passed on. We referred to him as Tex. And Tex basically introduced me back in 2013, so that's a decade ago, about the political citizenship status that we have. But 13 years ago, it was not known by me, and it was not divulged by Tex how to go about correcting your political citizenship status. GW, who is the speaker for these calls, the information provider assigned to the Monday night call about correcting your political citizenship status, began a little longer than 13 years ago. I think it's now 14 or 15 years ago, applying a process that he had learned through the naturalization and immigration process, which has been with us since the founding of our country. Yeah. And he just applies what they used to do back 248 years ago, I guess, when our country were had just translated from colonists into state citizens, and also as the sovereignty upon which our government is delegated its sovereignty. So at that time, they had lots of people here who did not consider themselves or would ever consider themselves as Americans. They were the Dutch, the Germans, the English, and the just everyone from around the world. They were here. So in order to identify those people who stood as an American, there was a simple process that was proceeded through, and that's basically what GW put together and has been using for this length of time, where he has not had a single traffic issue end up going south for the person who was behind the wheel of the car. And I hope that when he does return, he'll be returning Monday, the last Monday of January. When he returns, I hope you ask him about the system that he had been using for all those years, because it's now since been modified. When GW joined our team, well, our team is our legal beagles, you know, and they got involved, they got looking at it and saying, well, what about this, what about that, and those modifications have been made as well. So tonight we're going to talk about the court system that we have to work with and through, and I hope you enjoy this. If you want to follow along with me, go to www.AmericanByBirth.com, American by Birth. Underneath the header, you will see two ribbons streaming from right to left. One ribbon says, once we were colonists, subject to a king, a primer on jurisdiction. We always recommend that you read that multiple times, because that is the foundation. Once you have that rooted in you, then go to The Greatest Story Never Told, which is where I'm reading from now. So it's presumed, as I look at this board, there are no new people here, sadly. So it's people that are here and are going, either going through the process or are going to go through the process or have gone through the process. So you are more steeped in this. I presume already you have read Once We Were Colonists. And so let's talk about the court system tonight. This is the fifth chapter of the book. The court system of today is geared strictly for citizens of the United States, that is, members of this trust. If you're American with full constitutional powers, the courts have virtually no jurisdiction over you. They have nothing to offer you. It's true that they will take jurisdiction, they'll seize it, or attempt to take it under the presumption that you're a member of the trust, but the facts are clear in that no authority exists for the trust courts of today to take jurisdiction over an American national, unless by contract. What was that? Oh, yeah, unless by contract. That's because all courts, as you know them today, are commercial in nature. Yes, even matters considered criminal are commercial matters in a court of today. Ever wonder about the term charge in relation to an offense, what you've been charged with? The courts are commercial because they operate by contract under the national bankruptcy. So how do we get there? Since the courts operate commercially under contract, there's an overriding presumption that anyone who enters the court is a member of the trust, and therefore under contract for the court to adjudicate the problem being presented to it. Your silence is consent. So when you come forward and answer to the court, the presumption that you are a trusted member contracted to the court is therefore verified, and the court has gained jurisdiction. If you successfully rebut the presumption that you are a member of the trust, the court cannot gain jurisdiction over you, and it must rid itself of you in the fastest way possible. None of these courts are authorized to hear Article III cases because the states have fallen because there is no real money to back them. Therefore, if you are an American national who has not waived his constitutional rights by contract, you are immune from the jurisdiction of these courts unless you have intentionally damaged the life or the property of someone else. The courts are all trust courts, and their main function and duty is to protect the interests of the trust at all costs. They enforce the statutes and the codes, and the statutes and the codes are intended for use by the trust and its members only. In other words, they're special and private in nature. I realize this is going to be a big bite to swallow, so I'll attempt to break this down into very simple forms. Remember that all power flowed or flows from the state citizen, the union state citizen, the state citizen in perpetual union, otherwise known as an American national, down to the state and then further down to the United States. The powers given are specific, and they have changed very little in the 248 years since they were established. The jurisdictional authority passed down was very limited as it applied to Americans, and almost unlimited as it applied to anyone else with whom the United States might be dealing with. This was all well thought out, and it was exactly what the Founding Fathers intended. They wanted the United States to deal with foreign countries with full authority, because that would be the best way of providing for the safety and convenience of the individual republics which it represented. They wanted very little authority passed to the United States over Americans because they had full intentions of remaining the sovereign. Remember, the purpose, the main purpose of the federal court system, and therefore the federal laws, was to adjudicate problems between the states, settle controversies in which the United States was a party, and settle matters between Americans, American nationals, and foreign states or its citizens, and to govern in the very limited areas of jurisdiction for which authority was given over or delegated by the American national, the state citizen in perpetual union. The other purpose of the federal laws was to govern federal citizens. So what is a federal citizen? In essence, there is no difference between a federal citizen and a citizen of the United States. Simply, it is that person who resides, keyword, within the trust and its possessions, who cannot or does not claim state citizenship of one of the several states in perpetual union in one of the 50 republics of this union. A prime example of a federal citizen today who has no choice would be Puerto Ricans. Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. In plain language, that means that the United States owns Puerto Rico. And as such, it became a part of the trust as a result of the 1933 bankruptcy. Its citizens are citizens of the United States. They're trust members, but they are not American nationals. They do not have constitutional rights, but they do have civil rights under the terms of the trust membership. In other words, they have the privileges and immunity provided by the 14th Amendment, but not the true rights guaranteed by the Constitution for Americans. The United States had to have laws in which to govern the growing numbers of federal citizens. These citizens increase every time a new immigrant applies for and is granted admission into the United States. No state allows these new immigrants passage into this country, so they all come as a result of federal authority. Therefore, the citizenship that they seek and may eventually be granted is always federal citizenship, i.e., as a citizen of the United States. It is warded by first granting limited membership into the trust by the issuance of a Social Security number, and later by bestowing full trust benefits. They can never become American nationals, as they will never have full constitutional powers because you are either an American from your birthright or you will never be. Virtually all the federal laws are written to govern the federal citizens. Now, we do have a stipulation here. You can, if you are a foreigner, also, everything that's been talked about so far is the first definition of United States in Black's Law Dictionary. You've heard me say it before. John Doe, comma, the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to other sovereigns in the family of nations. That's the first definition, and that's what we just talked about, to be an American by your birthright. But there's another way. It's called naturalization. And once you have become a United States citizen, you simply correct the record to become the third definition of United States. And what is the third definition of United States? Give me 1 second. We're going to pull it up. I should have had it ready. My apologies. Dum 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 dum. Here it comes. Slowly but surely. Oh. Here we go. All right. So. So we have the third definition. It may be the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. The second definition is federal citizens. It designates the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. The people of this territory are federal citizens. So when you come into become a citizen of the United States, you initially step foot in definition number two, but you can correct your political citizenship status and be and become a citizen of one of the collective states which are united by and under the Constitution. Get how it works? All right. Only the laws which specifically address issues for which jurisdiction was specifically given in the Constitution affects only American nationals. And again, you're an American national by either the first definition of birthright or the third definition by having corrected your political citizenship status, having been naturalized, sorry about that. Those issues are also known as common law issues or American common law issues. In other words, actual intentional damage has to be inflicted upon another person's life, liberty, or property in order for jurisdiction to be taken over an American national. But federal laws, using plenary power and authority, have no constitutional limits other than the due process placed upon them and can grant jurisdiction to the government for any reason that the government wishes. These laws can be changed at will with very little effort, many times by nothing more than simply a bureaucrat writing a new regulation. And the intention of the perpetrator is really, truly not an issue. So that a person who commits an actual crime without intending to do so or knowing that he's even done so is affected. Laws such as these give the government almost total control over the people, the federal citizens. Unfortunately, because there is no limit as to the legislative authority of Congress over its possessions, the power to govern was easily transferred to the trust with regards to its members. This is why most who are hearing these calls that we're doing every Monday night of the week are currently bound by the private law of the trust, which is being administered and enforced by someone other than the de jure republic federal government. Common laws do not require an elaborate court system because they could easily be decided in the local communities by the citizenry, as they are clear and virtually indisputable. In the days when this was understood, i.e. pre-Civil War, you had a trial by jury. The jury heard the facts, understood the law, and could overrule the law if they so chose to. That even worked in a degree with Prohibition much, much later after the Civil War. The judge simply made sure everybody followed the rules of procedure. That was it. The judge was not to have an opinion, be biased one way or another, to care less, supposedly, whether the defendant or the plaintiff or the prosecutor won. Didn't matter to him. Just make sure everybody follows the rules. It was the jury that you were tried by, your peers. By the way, on an aside, if you have corrected your political citizenship status, are federal citizens your peers? I think you know the answer to that. The rules and the regulations of the trust are anything but clear, and disputes are what makes the system work. They're aptly named codes, meaning that some special action to unlock the secrets contained therein is necessary to understand the meaning. The trust operates totally in commerce, and it operates under bankruptcy. Therefore, everything it does is aimed at protecting the creditor's collateral in this bankruptcy. Thus, the primary thrust of the codes is to give creditors an unfair advantage over the debtor and to protect the collateral. Here we must remember that people are the primary collateral in this bankruptcy. Your flesh and blood is the primary collateral, which is why you're deemed, quote, a property and franchise, end quote, of the United States. Therefore, the first duty of the trust is to protect the people in a manner consistent with the needs of the trust, not with the needs of justice for the people. And that's why a number of codes that tend to limit the individual freedoms that most of you believe that you have are constantly contradicted. As an example, let's take the seatbelt law. Clearly, there is no purpose for the seatbelt law, as it refers to common law, because there's no greater or lesser danger to another party whether you're wearing a seatbelt or not. It may affect you, but doesn't affect other parties. The trust is depending upon your continued contributions to the maintenance of this trust, and therefore wearing a seatbelt could easily extend to the period of time in which you could remain a productive member of the trust. You get into an accident, you get a seatbelt on, you're more likely to survive. If you survive, then you're going to go back to work and pay taxes. That's why you have a seatbelt. Not wearing a seatbelt could cause you to become an instant drain upon the trust. Therefore, you are assessed a penalty if you're caught not wearing a seatbelt. It's just like a little insurance premium to protect the trust's collateral. Criminal matters work in almost the same manner. Charges are brought up against an accused. Note the term charges. It's actually a commercial term in nature. Under the commercial trust code, what appears to be a clear-cut case of murder can be twisted around to make the killer appear to be the victim, and what would otherwise be right to act in their own best interest can easily be taken away, quote, for the good of the many, end quote. Actually, it's all for the good of the trust. The original courts knew that two different classes of citizenship were present in the Union, and they knew that each class had to be treated differently. One had to be given constitutional rights, the other did not. After 1933, with the trust assuming virtually all of the duties previously handled by the de jure republic, the courts were handling trust cases under the codes almost exclusively. Trust members were much easier and safer for the courts to handle because they were subject to the trust membership rules, and they had no real power or rights other than that passed by the 14th Amendment. Therefore, the consequences of ruling improperly over these people were really minimal. There is a point of a spear or of a dagger that you can thrust into them and poke them with. It's called deprivation of rights under color of law, but that only applies if you're an American national. It becomes clear that it would be in everyone's best interest if the government could classify all people as members of the trust. Thereby, no one's having to worry about changing procedures and rules on a case-by-case basis. And obviously, it would be much preferred if all could be treated as citizens of the United States. But how could that be possible? The answer came about in the actual paperwork required for the court's records. At the top of each document filed in a court case, there appears what is called the styling of the cause. This includes the exact name of the parties and their respective position of being either the plaintiff or the defendant. In the names came the answer that the government was looking for. An individual American's name, sometimes referred to as his Christian name, is written in proper English with a capital letter at the beginning of each name and lowercase letters for the remainder of the name. You know, Michael Edward would be uppercase M, lowercase I-C-H-A-E-L, uppercase E, lowercase D-W-A-R-D. Initials are not used for first or middle names. A corporation's name is spelled out using all capital letters. when you see the state of Texas or the state of Florida or the state of Maine, whatever, it's always all uppercase. And in case you did not already know, corporations are artificial entities. They're creatures created by and therefore subject to the code. Here's a word for you. Represent. An attorney's going to represent you. Represent you. When you go sui juris, the court's saying you are representing yourself. You're representing yourself. Why is that? Because they're going to deal with this creature. They're not going to deal with the flesh and blood man. They can't. Because an American national has unlimited power to contract, he can easily enter into a contract and become or act as an artificial entity for a special reason. In the court system being applied today, we all become artificial entities by contractual agreement as soon as we respond in any fashion to the court using the name of the artificial entity, i.e. your name, your appellation in all uppercase. In doing so, we state to the court, we're therefore acting on behalf of our corporate entity instead of the living man. In all cases, the styling will be in all capitals, and responding with anything other than a jurisdictional challenge by special appearance will give jurisdiction to the court, because it will be stating that you wish to be treated as a citizen of the United States under the trust rules, which are codes for the duration of these proceedings. So what do we say every time, and you students on the call tonight that have gone through litigation training and teaching through John and others on the other information providers? Every time you have a pleading, every time you open your mouth, the first words out of your mouth is, I present myself by special appearance, not general appearance. Always, always, always. In a criminal case, when the charges are read, you can be assured that the styling of the cause is in all capital letters. Therefore, if you make a pleading, you're asking the court to take jurisdiction under a contractual agreement for the duration of this cause, and the court will rule by commercial law, not American common law. They'll rule according to the trust code. You also note that it most cases, there will be a corporate United States flag. A corporate United States flag has yellow fringe hanging in the courtroom, indicating that you're in a commercial tribunal to be governed by trust law. And there are some things which you should be made aware of. First, many of the offenses for which you may be criminally charged are not laws for which an American national be held liable. For instance, willful failure to file an income tax return. Well, let's say that the government has indicted you for willful failure to file and you are brought before a federal judge for arraignment. He will read or have read the charges which the government is bringing against you. At the end of the reading, he should ask you if you understand the charges. You should always immediately challenge both the jurisdiction of the court and the jurisdiction of the agency making the charge. Actually, the team that we have here will have already established, before you even get that far, proper jurisdictional challenges, so that it is the overwhelming presence of a jurisdictional challenge before you even get into court. So before a court can hear your case, it must have jurisdiction over both the parties and the subject matter. Personal jurisdiction is a geographical district over which the court has jurisdiction. Geographical. So, are any of the several states of the Union in perpetual union of the are they United States? No. They're the name of the state, California, Texas, Florida, whatever. If you're an American national and you do not live in the United States, where's the United States? 10 miles from the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves. And you did not commit the alleged offense in the United States, so you weren't, say, doing business and living in Washington, D.C. or Puerto Rico or whatever, then the court does not have personal jurisdiction over you. Subject matter jurisdiction refers to the type of charge and the issues involved. For instance, a federal court only has subject matter jurisdiction over an American national in the area of those specific powers delegated to it by the Congress, by the Constitution, excuse me, not by Congress, by the Constitution, all of which are common law in nature. You have a fair chance of this case being dismissed immediately if you properly challenge jurisdiction. However, because of the structure in place today, the court will make the presumption that you are indeed a member of the trust, and you will attempt and will attempt to rule accordingly. The problem you will face is that the court you are in and the judge that you are before does not have the authority to hear causes or make rulings under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, and that is where your remedy lies. Of course, it only is there and available if you have corrected your political citizenship status and are, in fact, indeed an American national. He can only adjudicate 14th Amendment issues, that is, trust issues. That's all he can do. He actually serves as an adjudicator of the facts under the trust for its members. If you're there, the presumption is that you're a member of the trust. Thus, your name and all uppercase and the presumption that you're required to follow is now to follow the trust rules. This overriding presumption also assumes your guilt. Not innocent until proven guilty. You're assumed to be guilty until you can prove yourself innocent. And proof can be established by the existence of certain, you know, very passive acts. In common law, innocence is presumed, and proof must be established by a willful affirmative act. Example. Under the trust codes, proof of a crime can be established by the fact that you failed to file a tax return. That lack of action could never lead to a conviction for a common law crime. Under the rules of the trust, however, that failure is a crime and can result in prison time. Once again, the focus of the code is to protect the creditors of the trust and not the members of the trust, while the focus of the common law is to protect the rights of an American national, the real man or woman. In trust courts, if the judge moves past your jurisdictional challenge, you still have a right to understand the exact law you're being charged with violating under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. In the case of willful failure to file, if you are an American national, wouldn't it be a little hard to understand how your servant, the government, or the trust that replaced it can bring a charge against you for something that you never gave it jurisdiction over? Repeat that. If you're an American national, wouldn't it be hard to understand how your servant, the government, or the trust that you created by birthright, your forefathers created, can bring a charge against you for something that you never gave it jurisdiction over? A bill of particulars, which is you have a right to demand, giving the exact law that you're charged with violating, may lead to a quick ending for the action against you. If you truly are not a member of the trust, an action of commercial nature against you is like the owner of a company being brought into court and sued by one of its low-ranking employees for not following a rule which the employee made up without any authority to do so. I mean, who makes up the rules in a company? The owner of the company makes up the rules. Here in this de facto government, which gets its power from you, the people, coming to you and charging you with criminally with failure to follow a rule that is set up without your approval or authority. That's what they're doing. Remember, all of this government's power flows from you. And since the trust gets its authority from the government, the same holds true for it. The truth is that by the terms of due process of the 14th Amendment from which their power is derived, they must tell you the exact law which you are accused of violating. If you understand the issues, it will be impossible for them to give you a law that says you, individually, uniquely, are required to file anything, and the case should be dismissed. But if you plead, quote, not guilty, then you've not only given jurisdiction for the duration of this cause to the court, you've also admitted that there is a law which applies to you. And basically, you've admitted that you are a member of the trust. And after that, it's just simply a question of facts. Did you or did you not file? You're no longer innocent until proven guilty. You're now a slave asking for your master's understanding and mercy. Remember, under commercial law, the presumption is guilt. To help you find the trees in the forest, imagine you were brought before a judge and charged with reading a book entitled Capitalism, the Right Way. Imagine that after the charge is read to you, you are told that the penalty, if found guilty for this crime, is 20 years hard labor. Now imagine that you're in, say, Dallas County, Texas, a courtroom with a United States federal judge in front of you, and he says, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty? How would you answer? What you might want to ask is, so what's the problem, even if I've read the book? What if the judge then tells you you're accused of breaking the law under the laws of the Red Chinese government? We have a treaty with them, and I need for you to plead guilty or not guilty. So what is it? What would you say? If you plead not guilty and you had read the book, you'd be committing a perjury, a crime punishable under American law, American common law, as well as admitting that this was a law which applied to you. If you plead guilty because you did, in fact, read the book, then sentencing would be all that's left to settle. This seems ridiculous, but this is exactly what the courts today do to American nationals. It charges them with a crime from the laws of a foreign state, which is the United States, the trust, which does not apply to you. And it does it in such a way it's very difficult for the unwary to escape the consequences that were never meant to apply to them. What you should do or consider doing, what I would do where I'm similarly situated, is to refuse to plead until jurisdiction has been fully proven and you understand what specific law it is that you have broken and how that law applies to you. You have a right to know and understand this. And you should object strenuously and continue in your objections if the judge tries to enter a plea for you. Once the plea is entered, it becomes much harder to challenge the jurisdiction of the court. If the judge still enters a plea, quote, on your behalf, end quote, you should immediately file an interlocutory appeal for special appearance, by special appearance. This appeal may have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, but it should be ruled in your favor because the Supreme Court has already ruled on this issue several times. Once in a court case, Higgins versus Levine, 415, U.S. 528, 533, and 5, the court says, quote, where jurisdiction is denied and squarely challenged, jurisdiction cannot be assumed to exist sub salientio, you know, because you didn't say anything. And it must be proven, end quote. If any, in any event, you have no other choice because they don't treat disobedient slaves very well. And to do anything else is admitting you are a slave. You are property in a franchise of the United States. Let's further examine the courts which you're likely to be brought before. It's common that most of the lower level judges don't even realize what they're doing in regards to the jurisdictional question. They almost all believe that if you live in their precinct or geographical area, or what they assume is their geographical area, they automatically gain total jurisdiction over you. Take, for example, a common traffic ticket. There are so many flaws in that instrument, that ticket. It's just unbelievable. First, it's the enforcement of a code. So the first presumption is that anyone who gets a traffic ticket is a member of the trust. And for the most part, this is correct, because in most states, you now have to give your Social Security number in order to get a driver's license. This practice is blatantly illegal, even by federal code. In United States Code Title 42, Section 408A8, Alpha 8, it states, quote, whoever discloses, uses, compels the disclosure of the Social Security number in violation of the laws of the United States shall be guilty of a felony and upon conviction, therefore, shall be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned for not more than 5 years or both. So we must find a place in the code which makes forcing the disclosure of the Social Security number in order to receive a driver's license unlawful. So for that, we go to Title 5, Section 552A, under the heading of Disclosure of Social Security Number. And there it states, it shall be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny to any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by the law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security account number, end quote. These two statutes are right out of the United States Code. It makes the action of refusal to issue a driver's license because of one's refusal to give a Social Security number a felony committed by the state and its employees. States rely on Title 42, Section 405C(i), which states, quote, "It is the policy of the United States that any state or political subdivision thereof may, in the administration of any tax, general public assistance, driver's license, or motor vehicle registration within its jurisdiction, utilize the Social Security numbers issued by the Secretary for the purpose of establishing the identification of individuals affected by such laws, and may require an individual who is or appears to be so affected to furnish to such state or political subdivision thereof, or any agency thereof having administrative responsibility for the law involved, the Social Security account number or numbers, if he has more than one such number, issued to him by the Secretary." Now, you should note several things here. First, as I emphasized, the word was policy, meaning it's not law. Second, this does not override any other law, because if it did, it would use the term notwithstanding such other law. Third, it uses a capital S in the spelling of the word state. This indicates it's referring to one of the states of the United States. What are states of the United States? Territories, possessions, enclaves. So when you see the state of Florida, uppercase S for state, uppercase F for Florida, it's talking about one of the territories of the United States. Next, it clearly says that this applies to any, quote, "individual who is or appears to be so affected," end quote. Obviously, there must be people applying for driver's license who would not be affected by this law. I wonder who they are. Last, this section comes before the section in the code making it a felony to deny a driver's license because of one's failure to disclose the Social Security number assigned to them. So Congress was not intending to end that mandate with this policy. The truth is that American nationals do not even appear to be affected. That is, if you know that you are an American national and can prove it. The problem that presents itself here for the government is that you do not use your Social Security number to get the driver's license, then the contract placing you into the state of voluntary servitude is not re-verified. And you probably don't need a driver's license to travel on the highways to begin with while in control of an automobile. Thus, the presumption is automatically made that anyone applying for a driver's license must be part of the collateral, or he would not be asking for the privilege to drive. The problem here is that many of the so-called law enforcement officers during their training don't realize that an American national is not bound by the trust codes unless they are members of the trust. And an American national can be constantly harassed if he tries to travel around the country without a driver's license. Also, no other form of identification is made available for American nationals wishing to use this form of travel. Well, that's not true. You can get, once you've corrected your political citizenship status, the State Department of the United States provides you with a pass card and a passport that looks like anybody else's pass card and passport until you run it. And when they run it, then the officers are told not to further investigate, to release you, and all sorts of other things. Most of the law enforcement officers are absolutely so ignorant that they actually believe that they're protecting freedom, when in fact they're the frontline tool being used to undermine the freedoms of every true American national. Well, let us move forward assuming that you've gotten a driver's license by using your Social Security number, then you get a traffic ticket. The lower courts call this a criminal offense. The problem is that in most states, it's a civil statute which is being enforced. In Texas, as an example, all traffic laws are found in Vernon's civil statutes. Yet, the all-uppercase state of Texas attaches criminal penalties to the violations of civil statutes. Well, how can that be? The maximum penalty available to the courts in Texas for most traffic offenses is a $200 fine. Nowhere in the law is any jail time provided for a traffic offense, yet the county jails are full of people who have done no more than simply failed to pay a traffic fine. Does this amount to a debtor's prison? The truth is, it does. As a member of the trust, you've submitted to these rules. The courts will tell you that a fine is not a debt, but they can't show you any way that they have a legal right to put you in jail for any traffic offense, even under the ungodly code. There are even United States Supreme Courts, the trust, the state courts, the trust courts, who say that the penalties imposed cannot exceed the maximum penalty provided by law, which is even 1 hour of imprisonment. But they do continue to lock people up anyways. So how does that happen? The overriding question is, how can the courts get away with these rulings? And as I said earlier, American nationals can only be tried under American common law. Under the federal law, the federal courts only have jurisdiction given them by the Constitution. Now, Black's Law Dictionary defines federal common law, quote, as a body of decisional law developed by the federal courts. The application of this body of common law is limited by the Erie Doctrine and by the Rules of Decision Act, which provides that except for cases governed by the Constitution, the treaties of the United States, or by acts of Congress, federal courts are to apply state law. Now think about this definition. Common law only applies in cases governed by the Constitution. But I thought all cases were governed by the Constitution. Not a case involving a member of the trust with rights, and I put that in quotes, only under the 14th Amendment, that is, as a citizen of the United States, because in reality, these rights are not rights, they're privileges. This is why American common law has almost lost virtually every case in the courts today, because as a trust member or someone who thinks he is and doesn't object to being treated like one. This system started in 1939 with a Supreme Court case of Erie Railroad Company versus Tompkins, 304 U.S. 64. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that state law, commercial or trust law, would be the standard of the federal court system from that date forward in all cases except those governed by the Constitution. That completely changed the course of the federal judiciary and ushered in the Uniform Commercial Code, otherwise known as the UCC. And this was now the standard for all future cases. The UCC is Admiralty Maritime Law, which is supposedly reserved for courts outside of the United States of America. But, and that's upper lower case when I said that. But through the deceit and confusion, it's become the law of the land. What actually happens is that you leave America when you step into an admiralty courtroom which applies the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. UCC is the law under which all statutes, codes, and regulations dwell, but it is still not applicable to any American national. That is why all courts must get you to agree to be treated as a citizen of the United States, that is, a member of the trust, and if you don't, they have no jurisdiction. There are many who believe that simply stepping through the rail gate, the bar, which separates the viewing area, the audience, the gallery, from the actual courtroom, gives the court jurisdiction over your person and basically admits the contract. The hiring of a member of the bar attorney definitely submits to the jurisdiction, Regardless, the UCC is contract law. It's contract law and in its strongest, most evil form, because it strips the American national of all their God-given rights, constitutionally protected rights, and judges now affirm them as an artificial entity, a corporation, or a slave. Again, you're represented. The UCC does not recognize or account for the fact that the sovereignty lies within the people. It only looks at the facts, supposedly facts, according to admiralty law or commercial law. However, it does not protect itself, and in doing so, this gives the American national the sword he needs in court. At UCC 1-103.6, it states, quote, the code is complementary to the common law, which remains in force except where displaced by the code. A statute should be construed in harmony with the common law unless there is a clear legislative intent to abrogate the common law, end quote. With regards to the American national with full constitutional rights in place, there can be no legislative intent to abrogate the common law without an act of treason on the part of the legislature, because the legislature was never given the authority to abrogate the common law with respect to the American people, the American national. So what the UCC attempts to do is to trick an American national into giving up his or her rights through the contracts. Does that sound familiar? At UCC 1-207.9, it states, quote, when a waivable right or claim is involved, the failure to make a reservation thereof causes a loss of rights and bar its assertions at a later date, end quote. How many times have you heard me say on the previous calls, if there's a place I have to sign something, I always sign, I reserve all rights, I waive no rights, and then I'll sign my name. I establish it right there at the very beginning. And as we've already learned, almost any right is waivable by contract. So this is a very encompassing and damaging section. In reality, it means that anything which is claimed against you becomes a real liability to you, which cannot be refuted after the initial claim has passed. So if I'm asked to sign a traffic ticket, all rights reserved, no rights waived, and then I sign it. And I'll even put TDC after I've signed something. TDC stands for threat, duress, and coercion. Was I threatened? Well, the guy that handed it to me to sign was wearing a sidearm. Hell yeah, I was threatened. Someone sends you a bill for $100 for a service which you did not receive. You assume that this is just an error in billing and you disregard it without any action. The party who sent you the bill now has verified the claim against you for which you have now no defense. You owe the $100. The IRS uses this method on a regular basis. They send you a bill, and you do not immediately and properly deny the bill, so the bill becomes due and payable, and there is no defense for you. There's a remedy provided within the UCC for the situation, but you're not going to use that because you don't have the UCC to work with. You're an American national, right? But if you are a federal citizen, you should learn to use it in all your situations. It's found that UCC 1-207, and it's been changed now, so you have to get the current. It says, quote, a party who will explicit reservation of rights performs or promises performance or assents to performance in a manner demanded or offered by the other party does not thereby prejudice the rights reserved. You see, in American common law, I'm simply typing or writing at the top of it, of where I will be signing, all rights reserved, no rights waived. So, as an American national, all rights reserved, no rights waived, Michael Edward, TDC if you're carrying a gun. If you're a federal citizen, 1-207. Such words as without prejudice or under protest or the like, that's also sufficient. In other words, you can enter into a contract within the system, and by using the words without prejudice along with your signature on any contract, you retain all your rights. I don't trust that. I trust all rights reserved, no rights waived. And so since you can retain all your rights, you're not bound by the adhesion contracts, which might be reduced or totally remove your rights. An adhesion contract is one which offers a form contract with no room for bargaining. And those contracts offered on today's market, they're almost all attached to other contracts which you don't even know about, and therefore you're signing a contract agreeing to stipulations for which you're not even aware of. You are, nonetheless, liable under the unknown to you provisions. This is one of the primary ways that you give up your rights as an American national. And it should be noted that the use of the word without prejudice is a common law remedy which dates back hundreds of years. When you are brought into court for any reason, the court will take silent judicial notice of the fact that you've entered into one or more of these contracts which bind you in your corporate self to the jurisdiction of this trust court, which is why if you are in a situation where you hire the team has put in the very beginning all of these challenges, jurisdictional challenges to begin with, and you are taught the mantra, my presence is special, not general in appearance, and other things like that. There is, however, still a way to deny the court jurisdiction. If you do not enter the contract in its entirety, knowingly, willingly, and intentionally, you can refute the contract and declare it null and void under the constructive fraud statutes. You must, however, take action because the court will not assist you in this action. To the contrary, the court will make it difficult as possible for you to take this action. Even with the court's prejudice, you can still claim this right. The key here is to deny any contract which might bind you to trust in any way, or reject and deny all the benefits afforded by the trust. You cannot accept the benefit, that is, the use of the Social Security number in any way, and then refuse to be bound by the trust rules. This is not always true, because we've learned since then that we can define the land jurisdiction and the personam jurisdiction, as well as the nature and the cause of the charges against you, i.e. the subject matter jurisdiction. The more knowledge you acquire, the harder it is for you to be, for these, you know, lords, if you would, to use their false power over you. There is one other great asset provided to you by this ungodly code that is intended to strip away your freedoms, and it's the main tool which is used against you. Remember that an unrebutted claim stands as truth in this system. You can use that to your advantage because it works both ways. Basically, you are what you say you are. You can claim to be almost anything you want to be, and if you do so by sworn affidavit, it stands as unquestioned truth unless rebutted by a sworn affidavit challenging it. Since no one on the other side is able to swear to anything, you can claim virtually anything you want. A man of African descent from South Africa who's been in this country one day can claim by sworn affidavit to be a white Native American. And absent of an opposing affidavit, that statement would stand as proven fact in these trust courts. Therefore, if you understand the system, you can turn it around to fit your needs as you like. So it's very easy to prove in court that you are a fully constitutionally empowered American national. You simply put it in a sworn affidavit form, file it in the public record, submit it to the court, and dare anybody to challenge you. And don't worry, nobody will. Now, remember me telling you about or sharing with you about other people on the internet, you know, selling their different processes by which they correct your political citizenship status? It's only one page, friends. There's only one place to send it to get the ball moving. And there's only one action between you and the State Department that accomplishes it. That's it. But you ask, if these are truly all factual, how could it have ever come to pass that these banksters have been able to gain and keep all this undeserved power? The American people have become mice that are either too scared, way too ignorant, or woefully apathetic to do anything about the theft of their rights and their country. And for the most part, they have sold their liberty and their freedom for a loaf of bread or a six-pack of beer. Some are beginning to wake up and realize what has been given to them, and they want it back. And for those, the years ahead will be challenging, but they will also be very rewarding. For others, they should remember that slave owners are not always benevolent, and they can change it on their own will. These would-be slaves should look, you know, back in time at the hundreds of societies, including our own, in which the people gave their hearts, their souls, their lives, trying to free themselves from tyrannical totalitarian rule. What they fought and died for, moreover, what our founding fathers fought, died for, left us our birthright. And now we hand it back to these masters without so much as a whimper? What a disgrace. Our founding fathers must be tossing wildly in their graves. So, this concludes tonight's reading. I want to remind you that we do have the vehicle on its way back to take us back to where we need to be. It's called Grass Fire Communications. It will be launched very shortly after the first of the year. We've had updates on it even today. And when we do, it'll be up to you as a core group of people to share this Grass Fire Communications with other people, as well as sharing the website, AmericanByBirth.com. Once we were colonists.com, just give them something to read real quick. And we can restore our republic. It is the heart's desire of every member of this team, the team that we have here at Your Remedies in the Law, to restore the vision of our founding fathers. And with you, we can do it. Next week, we're going to talk about the remedy that still exists, which I've covered somewhat tonight. So let's go with opening up for Q&A. So press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see a place in the center right of your monitor that looks like a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of that, type away your comment or your question. And then I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. Again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, I'm going to say nighty-night. And then we'll return tomorrow with Brother John, prayerfully. Let me refresh in case my machine is playing with me here. Yep, there's Charlie. Good time, Charlie.
All right. Okay. Tell me again, TDC stands for?
Threat, duress, and coercion.
Write down, threat, duress, and coercion, okay? And
I had decades ago somebody say to me, well, you can't put that after your name, threat, duress, and coercion. I said, threat, duress, and coercion? What are you talking about? Theological divinity, something, Congress. Theological divinity. They said, oh, you a pastor? And I said, pastor, go ahead, Charlie.
Where you, I'm just looking here, you cannot accept the benefit, accept the use of Social Security number in any way, and then refuse to be bound by the trust rules. And
okay,
you,
so understand, this was written like over a decade ago, and okay. Much has been better understood today than back then. There's, let me see if I can find it real quickly here, 3 court cases that just clear everything up very, very nicely. Bear with me. I'll find it in a second. Almost. Come on.
And the court cases you're looking up, are they in? I'm looking for the title of that short. Let's see.
Yes, they are.
Okay. If you might give me the page they're on, if I assume our page number is.
I got to find it first.
Okay.
There they are. Okay. So it's it's not telling me the page. Anyways, Houston versus Moore. Moore versus Illinois, and United States versus Cruikshank. This is about, I'd say one-third of the way into all the pages, so it's probably about page 7, 8, 9, something like that. Houston versus Moore, 18 U.S. 133. It's an 1820 decision. Here it is. Every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protections and participates in the government of both the state and the United States. 32 years later, in 1852, Moore versus Illinois, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may, not shall, may be liable to punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. Okay. So it sounds like we're going to get it from both sides, but here it is in Cruikshank. It is the natural consequence of a citizenship, which owes allegiances to two sovereignties and claims protection from both. The citizen cannot complain because he has voluntarily submitted himself to such a form of government. He owes allegiance to the two departments, so to speak, and within their respective spheres must pay the penalties for each exacts for the disobedience of his laws. In return, he can demand protection from each within its own jurisdiction. So sphere and jurisdiction are synonymous. Right there it says, he has protections within their own spheres. He has potential penalties within their own spheres. That's it. Right there. So
excellent.
Where are you tonight? Where are you tonight right now? What state?
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma. Now, is that Oklahoma, one of the several states in perpetual union? Or is that the state of Oklahoma, a state of the United States?
Well, I guess until I correct my political citizenship, that
No. Frankly, you can wink. If you knew what I knew, and if you knew what John knows and so many other people, we'd have to do that. They're asserting, there's a maxim of law that says that the one who asserts upon challenge must evidence the assertion or the challenge is void, basically. So they're asserting I'm a federal citizen. Remember, I just covered that in what I read back to you tonight. They're asserting I'm a federal citizen. So I challenge it.
Gotcha.
However, the easy button to push is to correct your political citizenship status, and that way you can stop this from moving forward prayerfully at the side of the road when the officer pulled you over and said, let me see your driver's license, proof of insurance, and registration. Well, let me get that for you, officer, but I have right here State Department ID. You can start with that, and let me just start looking through my papers here for the rest of what you're wanting.
Gotcha. Yeah. The easy button. and that is on page 7, as I printed it. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
No. Not.
I'm going to check Freedom's Radio. All right. So press star 2 on your keypad. I'm going to go check Freedom's Radio. I'll be right back. See what we got here. Nobody asking questions there. Got a good group. That's good. Anybody else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, it's going to be nutty night. All right. Thank you all for joining me this evening. It's glad to read you a bedtime story. And we'll return tomorrow night with Brother John and go from there. And if for whatever reason, if Brother John cannot make it, then I will go on to the next area of this discussion, which will be a remedy that exists. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.